Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening, Jim Jarvis here, along with my co-host Han Tron. Han, how are you today?
I am marvelous, Jim. I am doing marvelous.
Excellent.
Welcome. Go ahead, bud.
So I just wanted to say welcome to everyone. Episode number 43 of Straight Talk. Tonight's episode is another interesting one, only because it's very impromptu, because we've received and have numerous piles of questions that have come in. And there is actually a trend that's kind of starting. What we're seeing is that there's been quite a few questions that kind of deal with the subject matter of starting your own practice or startups. So that's what we're going to do tonight. Tonight, we're really going to talk about the answers to these particular questions that we have, along with anything else that comes out that's part of it. I'd like to say thank you to all those that have sent in questions. Please feel free to continue to do that. If you need location, go to our website, www.hjtdesign.com. Right there on the front page where it says listen live to the radio show, you click on that button, and then there's a tab or a link there that allows you to actually fill out a questionnaire form. Really, it's only got, I think, three categories in it. Your name, if you want to put it in there, along with your question, and your email address if you want to give it to us. You don't have to, and send it off, and we'll do everything we can to, if we need to, we'll add more and more episodes of questions from our listeners. So Han, you were going to say?
No, I was just talking about the weather.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, we had some rain tonight this evening, which was actually kind of good because we needed it here, but I'm sure it's perfect down in Florida, right?
It's always perfect, including during the rain, right?
I understand. Yeah, without a doubt. Well, let's start off with a question we got from, what is this, Dr. Mary over in Texas. I've been told and heard that I must sign a full contract. What do I do, or what is the process that I really should be looking at? That's an interesting and a complicated question, Doc, in the sense that we don't know exactly what you're trying to accomplish, but let's say it is under the context of a startup, that you want to start your own practice. So contractually, obviously you need to have a designer, an architect like ourselves, someone that will be able to pull together the team. Go back and listen to our previous podcast episodes about the team. It's a very thorough one that gives you an idea of all the folks that are involved there. But from a contractual standpoint, definitely you need to sign a contract. Don't do this on a handshake, or don't do this on a verbal, because it protects you as much as it protects everyone else. Now, when you say a full contract, I'm assuming you are talking to either a builder or a group that wants you to basically do everything with them. And that's a little different than us, isn't it, Han?
Yes. Yes, it is. A full contract, if you're dealing with a contractor, that's one thing. If you're dealing with an architect, that is another. But yeah, everybody, you know, everybody do things a little bit differently. We had found a sweet spot that allow us as well as our client to take things in progression and, you know, develop the program or develop their, you know, their design as we go. So, Jim, you go ahead and go into that a little bit, Jim.
Sure. Well, our process is really, we like to call it a two-part process in that initially, no matter whether you're going to do a lease space for a retail center, a lease space of an existing building, or even building something brand new, it doesn't matter. We have our first part, and our first part is the initial design concept. Now, that initial design concept is going to be a full floor plan that lays out the particulars of your adjacency, what happens within the particular space. If it's a existing retail center, then it's within the existing confinements of the walls that you want to lease out. Or if it's a brand new build, then it's within the existing constraints of the property that allows you to build whatever you want. So once we've determined the particular size and arrangement and shape, then it'll be we create a preliminary floor plan, which also could include a preliminary site plan if it's a new build. And that preliminary integrates everything from the particular equipment that you would like to have, along with at least an idea of it, not the specific equipment, but an idea of where you want to have. For example, if you wanted to have operatories that only had one cabinet station in it, or no cabinet stations, you know, all that kind of stuff gets integrated into it. But what I was getting at is that preliminary gives you enough information to give to a construction entity, or hopefully you take our advice and bring onto your team a construction manager, that construction manager to give you a ballpark estimate as to the cost to do your project. And either it's going to be a renovation cost of an existing building, or it's going to be a new cost for a new build. Then once you have that existing, or you have that information of a cost, then you can take that cost and sit down with your lending institution and your banker to be able to determine the financial feasibility of doing what you want to do. That is the first step. Now, it doesn't include a bunch of things that are under the full architectural step two. Step two is the full architectural package, which builds upon what step one was. Now, step two has a full architectural package. You integrate all the engineers that are necessary. You integrate your interior design folks, if you want to have them as part of it. All of the specifics, all the questions, all the little pieces and parts that have to be determined, it all culminates in a set of construction documents known as blueprints. And then you go into the building permitting process and approval process, and eventually through the bidding, and come out the other end with successful bidders, and hopefully start construction and move on forward with your construction of the process. So our two-step process is different in the sense that you have a real thorough initial package that allows you to get a real comfortable idea of what that cost is going to be, and then it allows you to then build upon that, so you're not wasting any time or money for the first part in the way of fees and that kind of stuff. So it gives you the opportunity to incrementally step through this process. So the idea of signing a full contract means that you pretty much are going to be stuck with the team that whoever you're going to sign with, and they're going to take the project from beginning all the way through to the end, and more than likely to build a thing. And so that's really the big difference between what you're being told And we understand the reservation, don't we, Han?
Yeah, it's either way will work, because that work has served us, you know, through most of our career. What we found is that the way we are separated, it gives us a little bit more flexibility, and it gives our clients a little more flexibility too. You know, some clients come to us and all they want is, you know, just the design aspect of our services, and they don't need, you know, they don't need the rest of the stuff, because they may have somebody already in the wing that they know that they would like to work with, that are local and whatever. But we find that, you know, it gives us, the architect and the client, you know, the options and a clean termination of services if that's all they want. Jim?
Right. Kind of like the best of both worlds. The scenario that Han was just talking about, which is a very common one, is you may even have an associate or a friend or a relationship with a local architect that you want to have do your building. And unfortunately, that architect doesn't have the expertise that we do. So it's like we're the specialists. You allow us to do the initial documents, then they can take over from there and finish up the rest of the project. Sometimes we're retained as a consultant to the local folks, and sometimes we're not. It all depends upon, you know, how the local architect, for example, feels about being able to finalize and perform. So we're really flexible in the sense that it gives you the total flexibility. So it's a win-win in the sense that you get the best of both worlds. But in your mind, you say, hey, I'd like to have this individual. They may even be a patient for all we know. And you'd like to have them as part of the team and be the individual that's here on a day-to-day basis. Well, you can do that. And so we have that opportunity.
We can take it one step further too, Jim. Is that often, even though we are retained to do the preliminary design, the reservation, you know, that an architect that doesn't have any dental experience is that you don't want them to kind of, pardon the pun, but cut teeth on your project. So you want to have at least a lifeline or a safety net, you know, in the wings, so in case that they need to reach out and, you know, and get some technical feedback and some advice and so like that, we do provide that safety net when we're involved in the project. Of course, you know, it's on more of a professional courtesy, but if the architect require more than simply, you know, hey, how do you do this, or what do you think about this, but want to be, us to hold his hand, and that would be, you know, a different level of consultation.
Yeah, there'd be a small fee associated with that, which is what's kind of nice about us. We don't set a standard fee. Our fee is based upon the amount of work that we're actually doing for you. So that's done for one reason and only one reason, and that's to give you the most economical solution. We're not going to say, here's our standard X fee. This is what you do. This is what you're going to come over and spend whatever, you know, days with us, and you're going to go through this stuff, and you're going to make all these kind of selections. You're going to walk away with a big bill and this set of documents. We don't do that. That's not how we roll. It's a totally different world. You know, our fee is based upon, again, what we do for you. Specifically, if you only need one thing done, we do that one thing. If you want a half a dozen things done, we do those half a dozen things. Whatever's best for you and to make it work for you. And we find that that's a better solution. It's a better solution all around and gives you a better result from all aspects. But mostly it cuts down on your frustration level. You know, you don't have to go out and take whatever you've given and then try to figure out what to do with it next. We're there to help you through all that stuff. Well, let's go to the next question, which is kind of a somewhat similar, but not similar in the sense that we've got Dr. Chris from Tennessee said, don't I really want to talk to the dental equipment folks first? All right, Han, I'll let you answer that one because I know you're chomping at the bit to talk about that.
Well, of course you want to talk to them. Not necessarily first. Okay. You will need to have them. Whether you buy refurbished or buy new, they're going to be involved at some capacity. But the main thing is, I'm trying to be nice. Is that if they have to do something, and it always bothered me that people promise to do things for free. Okay. I hope you weren't born yesterday, because my questions, sometimes I can be a smart aleck at time, and I ask them. If the supplier say that they would do, they would design your office for free, will they do it if you don't buy anything from them? And I have never heard the answer yes. Okay. They are good at what they do. They have a function. They should be on your team to help you finalize the equipment, select the appropriate equipment, shop for it, and all that stuff. But when it comes to designing, that's not, in our opinion, that's not their strong point. We have been blessed so many times with the product that they produce for our clients, and then we get to play architectural janitor. And that never set well. It only puts you in a bad situation. The worst probably if they do something and you love it for whatever reason and you buy the property and then find out that you can't execute what they have designed for you. So, no, Jim's right. It's a love-hate relationship. They're good folks doing good things when it comes to the equipment, but they don't really have any business messing with the design of the building. What I think sometimes it's worse is that when we design, we talk about startup, okay? So a lot of times startup are usually meant, a young dentist going into a medical building or a condo. But it's rare that they buy, a piece of land or a building and renovate to do their first startup. So this comment may not be specific for them. But when we design a project from the ground up, a raw piece of land or a new building, we design the building and the site together. So they work together. What drives me absolutely nuts is when a potential client came and say, I got so-and-so supplier designed me a building that's going to go onto the property that I'm looking to buy or I'm searching to buy. It's like taking the cart in front of the horse and ask the horse to run. It doesn't work well. Jim?
Yeah, without a doubt. And if you put this question in the context of a startup, is the sense that obviously that they have a relationship with the dental equipment folks. They see them a lot, and they are experts at equipment. No doubt about it. They're very valuable people and very valuable team people. And there's a trust level that's built there. We don't have a problem with that. And that's one reason why we do not tie ourselves to any particular equipment supplier. We're not tied to, Benco, Schein, Patterson. We work with all of them and gladly will work with anyone because we understand that their role, sometimes maybe better than what they do. We understand their role in the sense that they are the specialist when it comes to the equipment, and they're very valuable. as part of that team, but they're not the individual who should quarterback your team. You need an architect who understands the nuances, who's been trained for those aspects of life safety, of the code, dealing with construction, dealing with all the things that have to be dealt with. That you need that person to be in charge to lead the team, to be the quarterback, because that's what we're trained for. That's what the years and years of experience, the years and years of schooling, that's what we have poised ourselves to be, and that's what we bring to the table. So you need to have an architect that has that level of experience, specifically, as we always advocate, someone who understands a dental office and has done it numerous times before, because especially in an existing building, it's even more critical because you have to be able to evaluate what you're dealing with from the beginning. Han and I look at so many existing facilities, and you know, we'll look at a equipment layout done by an equipment supplier. And the very first thing is, well, this won't work because it doesn't meet code. What code? Well, the code that is enforced that mandates what you have to do for things like exiting, doorways, hallway widths, travel distances, fire ratings, ADA, meaning American with Disability Act, so the handicap code, restroom counts, drinking fountains. I mean, that's just a partial list of all the things that we have to go through and make sure that are in place or available and in properly in place that needs to be accomplished as part of what we do. Now, in that list that I just threw out there, there wasn't a single thing that a dental equipment supplier provides.
That's an important point.
They don't, because they're not trained for that. They are specialists on equipment. We are specialists on design. Big difference.
Buildings.
And so, yeah, big difference. And so we love them. They're great people. Just they shouldn't be in charge of leading the team. That's all. Does that make sense, Han?
Yep. This is for the startup as well. The term design. It can be as simple as I draw a box on a napkin to a very complex, official set of document that you can build from. So when you don't know the amount of work that's required or the amount of information that's necessary to allow you a accurate bid and things like that, you don't know what to ask, okay? Because you hear the term, we will design your office for you for free. Well, exactly what does that mean when you say design, okay? We interpret that word differently than those who are in the arena of placing chairs and x-ray units and pan and supplies, all right? The term, when you start out, whether you've done it for the first time or the second or third time, define that word design. Whoever you work with or whoever you're talking to, when they say we can design your office for you, ask them to define that, so that way you're not caught flat-footed. Okay, Jim?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that segues into the last point that I wanted to talk about, and it has to do with another team member that is designated as an interior designer. Now, what the heck is an interior designer versus an architect? Well, there's two big differences. One of which, an architect is a licensed professional who is mandated by law to get a license within a particular state based upon the criteria that that state have established so that they can provide the services and effectively take responsibility for the life safety issues and code fulfillment issues within that jurisdiction. A interior designer is not that. They do not have a license to fulfill that requirement. They look at the interior components of a building, specifically mandating around and looking at the areas of aesthetics, looking at configuration. Sometimes they'll delve into a few other areas to expand their expertise in the way, you know, things go together. But they are not a substitute, nor can they be legally. There's not a jurisdiction in this country that will allow you to build your building, either the inside or the exterior and interior, with a interior designer's stamp on it. First of all, they don't have stamps. They're not registered, and they do not have the ability to replace what the architect is responsible for. And that's by law. That's not, you know, that's not, go check it out for yourself if you don't believe us. That's by law in your particular state what's required. The law states that you have to have an architect that's professionally licensed and fulfilled all those requirements. It also states you have to have engineers that are professionally licensed and fulfilled their particular requirements to apply for and to get a building permit based around a set of construction documents that you can build from. You can't build from anything else, except I think there might be one or two states that allow you to build some small facilities and residential stuff that you don't have to have a registered architect for. But that's very far and few between. The majority of the country, different animal. The majority of the country requires that because it affects life safety. And the reason behind it all is all about the safety of the person and the public who's using your building, your public buildings. You bring clients into the building. They don't want the buildings to collapse. They don't want the buildings to burn down. They don't want people to get hurt. They don't want people to get killed. All those things are there for that reason and for that reason only. And that's the checks and balances, and that's the system we work in. So, you know, when it comes to the question of, don't I talk to the equipment suppliers first? You can talk to them anytime. They're part of the team. We want them as part of the team. We're not saying they shouldn't be part of the team. We're just saying that they shouldn't be the ones that lead the show. Does that make sense to you, hon?
Absolutely. Let me interject a couple of points regarding the interior designer on the team. If you commission a firm that have architect and interior designer, in the pecking order, the interior designer report to the architect. It's not the other way around. They're not. They collaborate together and stuff like that, but the individual ultimately have the responsibility and liability for the project, the design of the project, is the architect, not the interior designer. Another point is that if you put together a team where the architect is from another organization and the interior designer from another organization, please do yourself and your team a favor. Designate who leads the project, okay? Because you can't, that old saying is that too many chefs in the kitchen will spoil the soup. This is one absolute way to do it, is to not identify and assign who lead. It's natural in the whole design process that the architect lead, not the supplier, not the interior designer. Jim and I, we both had different experiences when working with interior designer. I myself had been with a firm where we have in-house interior design department. The architects on the job, on the project, always set the tone, set the parameter, set the aesthetic, and what they envision for the project, and the interior designer follow cue and execute, and fulfill that requirement. When you have an interior designer that wants to make a mark for themselves and want to go, rogue on the project, it's disastrous. It creates a lot of confusion, it just creates so much delay and unnecessary expense. So if you have one, bring them on. If you're thinking about working with an interior designer, bring them on early and introduce them to the team, and then identify what their role and what they're responsible for. So that way everybody know who's in charge and what they need to do. Jim?
So in a nutshell, from this aspect of the interior designer, we would not advocate that, whether it's a startup or any other project, that you go to a organization or a group or whomever that has an interior designer that creates a design and then says, okay, take that design and now go work with an architect. It's kind of like backwards. The interior of the project, even if it's a renovation or if it's a retail center, the interior of the project does not mandate or lead the project design. It's the overall project, meaning all aspects of the project are led by the architect that needs to lead the design. So you're basically asking for you're going down a difficult path. And a lot of work has to be reworked. A lot of frustration and potential of wasted funds are in that scenario. So we're not advocates of that. So, okay. Han, did you have a question you want to interject in, or you want me to go to my next one?
Yeah, let me ask mine. Okay.
Okay.
This is. Question from Dr. Nancy from New Hampshire. When it comes to type of site selection for a startup, what would be the ideal buildings should I look for? Should it be a medical office building, a condo, or retail space? So you want to give it a shot, Jim?
Yeah, that's actually a really good one, because there are some, and I think we did a little bit of this on one of the podcasts, if you go back and listen to that, but to recap a little bit, there are some buildings that are easily, existing buildings that are easily renovated and turned into dental practices. And then there are others that are extremely expensive. So the ones that we found that are easily renovatable, if that's a word, is, if you look at buildings that are designed under, first of all, they got to be designed under a commercial code. So make sure they're a commercial building. If they're a residential building, meaning a house, or any version of a house, be forewarned, be careful, because those buildings tend to have a lot of extra expense in them, because you've got to go in and bring it up to the commercial code. And that's things like firewalls, that's things like exits, that's things like stairways, that's things like corridor widths, all that kind of stuff that is totally different in the residential code than it is in the commercial code. Now, from a commercial building, let's say we pigeonhole this to commercial buildings. Okay. don't think that just because it was an existing, let's just pick one. It was an existing chiropractor's office that you could just go in and easily retrofit that into a dental office. Not so easy. It can be done, but it still means there's going to be a lot of walls being moved because chiropractor's offices flow totally different than a dental office. They have different size requirements for their exam rooms versus your operatories. And even if it was an existing medical office, let's say it's a family practitioner. Family practice offices, the exam rooms are dinky. I mean, you can do those things in, 8x6 or 8x8. Be hard pressed to, even with, some of the uber tight folks, you'd be hard pressed to put an operatory in an 8x8 or an 8x6. You won't be able to do that. So those things have to be looked at, but they're easily, that kind of stuff can be done because you just have to move walls around. Commercial buildings that are difficult to change into dental offices are ones like churches or things that are auditorium-ish that have sloped floors, that have large volume of spaces. Those kind of things tend to be more problematic and a little difficult to deal with. A health club, for example. And especially if it has a swimming pool, all that kind of stuff. That's not the easiest to go in and change to a dental office by just trying to fit the dental equipment in there. But banks are good. A lot of times banks fit the criteria of being in the right place physically. Han and I, just before the show, were talking about a project we did down in Findlay, and it was an old urology office. That particular office literally got torn down to the point of there was only one wall left for a bunch of other reasons, one of which the space didn't lay out properly, but second was because of all kinds of changes in the building code and the site requirements, meaning the right-of-ways that mandated a lot of things had to be changed just to make it work. But it was the perfect location for the doctor. And that had to be done to be able to take advantage of it. And it's a very successful final project and right now a very successful practice.
Yeah, assuming, I didn't set the parameter with the, the question is that assuming that all of your, all of the criteria as far as location, visibility, and all that are the same, okay? But the type of buildings that you should consider should be looked at with fine-tooth comb. So Jim had covered basically pretty much majority of the type of building. Medical office building is another one. We often you hear the term MOB, medical office building. Let me see. I use the acronym COB, and people go, "What the heck is a COB or a commercial office building?" Okay, we live in the world of now everything is acronyms, but commercial or medical office building. It gained its name because why? Because it was built for medical professionals. They're usually multi-story buildings. Multi-story buildings lend a little bit more difficulties in terms of of the actual work because you're in an occupied building. You will have adjacent neighbors upstairs, downstairs, beside you. The noise that generate during the construction process is annoying. If you're doing a build-out, it's about roughly 3 to 4 months of, of constant noise. Time constraint may be something that are imposed on the project where you can only do the renovation or the work after hours or during the weekend. You may have to gain access to the space below you so that the plumbing and all that stuff can
can be done. All of that, there's a lot of logistic issues with commercial and or medical office building, particularly if you're on the upper floors. Okay, one of the buildings that are building types that we've seen a lot in the recent years are retail space, or retail spaces. They're pretty much the things that you need to consider when you look at those retail spaces is, will you be there for a long time? 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20, and so on. Will you be there and grow your practice there after 10 years? All those questions need to be put on the table, considered, and your business plan, so that way you select the most ideal location within those retail, spaces, so that you can grow. Some of the discussions that I participate in is like, NCAP. Now, NCAP would be referring to, if you're in a retail strip, you'll be at the end unit. Okay, who don't want to be seen in the end unit? The problem with the end unit, in my opinion, is that if you're going to grow in place, hopefully your neighbor vacate and you can grow in, expand into that space. But that's only one neighbor if you're at the end cap, okay? Secondly, when you're at the end, you get a lot more window. Who doesn't love natural light? But the challenge when you're in a retail facility is that most of the time the window goes down to the floor or just about 18 inches or so above the floor, because it was designed as a retail space. Retail means you want people to see into the store to see the merchandise. Okay, it was not designed as a dental facility. So when you have windows, the good point is daylight. The bad point is you want to have your patient sit in the chair, get a good view of the parking lot or the hood of the car they park outside, and at the same time, those that are walking outside get a clean shot of your patient sitting in the chair. Modesty is a big issue that need to be looked at. But retail space is a very popular thing nowadays. I myself have visited a dentist's office inside a mall. And when I talked to the folks at that facility, they had several in the area, in the Tampa Bay area. So you're seeing dentist office actually built inside the mall to capitalize on the foot traffic. It's interesting. Okay.
I guess that is. Well, another area that has to be really concerned about, and we've talked about that back in some of our previous podcasts, but in a retail center, you have to really look at and address parking.
Yes,
because you may be in a situation that you are either underparked or you don't have enough parking in close proximity to where your particular space is. And then also how your staff and where your staff is going to park. Don't just assume that you get to pick whatever parking spaces you want the staff to be at, because there might be criteria, and there might be things in the actual lease document that state staff has to park in the back 40, or they have to park in another location, or they have to park in only these particular spots because the other agreements with the other tenants within that center says that these areas or these parking spaces are dedicated for customers. So keep that in mind when you're looking at a retail center. And then also, the other aspect is the breakout of who's responsible for what. The big one is your HVAC system, heating, air conditioning. Who's responsible for that particular unit up there and where does the change or the break occur where you're responsible for whatever you're responsible for. That along with demising walls, walls that separate you from the other tenants and what the requirements are. So they're kind of complicated. They're a little more detailed, and that kind of goes back to why you need the architect as the quarterback or the team leader, because that's what we're trained for. That's what we understand. That's what we look at. That's the filter that we look through when we evaluate things. And that's an important point that we really haven't talked about it very much, in that if you're looking at a variety of spaces, or you may be looking at this space or that space, ask us, please. We'll evaluate. We'll give you an evaluation of what, you know, this space over here, space A compared to space B, and whether there's an advantage or a disadvantage to either one of those to help you before you make the decision. It's never too early to ask for that advice, and actually you set yourself up to have an opportunity to potentially save a lot of money. You can save yourself a lot of money by having that information early, as opposed to saying, no, I'm going to pick that space because that's the one I like, and not have the professional like ourselves go through it and identify the areas that might cost these extra costs that weren't really evaluated and or weren't part of what the landlord said he would be taking care of. So that all falls on you. And we've seen that happen a lot, haven't we, Hon?
We've seen it happen all the time. For instance, you know, Jim mentioned about parking, and that parking is huge. A dentist's office require more parking requirement than a family doctor, okay? Attorney office or whatever other businesses, a dentist's office require more parking. So don't underestimate your parking need and go into a building and then you realize that you're kind of push yourself in a corner. Now, what do you do? Okay. Get a second opinion. Look at it logically, rationally, and have a few eyes look at it and give you the pros and cons. Don't, like our friend George Bell said, don't wear your rose-colored glass to the table and look at things and fall in love with it before it actually, you know, makes sense for and meet your requirement. All right, Jim?
Yeah. More questions? Our next question is from Dr. Eric over in Georgia. He said, I'm in a situation where I want to start a new practice, but I'm trying to determine whether I should lease an existing space or buy land and build. Because where I'm at, it's very difficult to lease existing spaces. Well, actually, that's not an uncommon thing, Doc. Because finding the right existing space or existing building is obviously crucial. We've kind of touched a little bit about that on tonight's show. Obviously, go back to listen to some of our other podcasts about this particular subject, but it is crucial that you have the right space. And Han, you've touched on it too, in the sense that, are you going to be in this space for 5 years, 10 years, or is this your forever space? Meaning, you know, I want to be here. I like this location. I like everything about it. It's real close to where I live. It's got beautiful access to everything. So I'm looking at 20 plus years. Well, to answer your question, Doc, in the sense that should I buy and build or should I lease, it really has to do with a whole lot of questions. And those questions are you going to be in that space forever? And then the question that Han and I and Bill are going to ask you is, why wouldn't you buy it as opposed to lease? Because if you lease forever, you know the business ramifications of that. You never know what's going to happen at any given time. That building could be sold to somebody else. That building could be sold from out from under you after your lease, and you're basically done. you're no longer in control of that facility. Now, if you're going to be in this space for 5 or 10 years, that's a totally different scenario. And it may mean that leasing is the best solution because you see it as a transition into the next step while you're getting yourself set up so that you can actually go out and buy a piece of property or buy a building and renovate or build new. Now, the other part of the thing, which Han and I don't get a lot involved in, that's what we leave the folks like Live Oak and others to deal with, is financially. Are you financially able to take on buying the piece of property, building the building, paying for the necessary fees and soft costs that are necessary to be able to put up that practice? Now, if you're able to do that or can make that all work, then that's the best scenario. It really allows you to be in total control. But if your mindset is, I'm only going to be here for 5 to 10 years, and I kind of want to see what this whole area is about while I'm building my practice, well, maybe building new isn't the direction that you want to go. But if you're forced to, because you can't find a lease space that's right, the worst thing you would do is go into the wrong place from a lease standpoint, either wrong in the sense of location, wrong in the sense of adjacency to other things, or wrong in the sense that it's exorbitantly expensive because you have to pay this high inflated cost because of what's going on with the economy. Han, what would you say?
I say buy.
Be an owner.
Because you have more, you're in more control of your destiny. Okay? You can be, for instance, you can be in a, you know, a huge mall. And you go like, you know, it's a successful mall and I'm going to be here for decades. Well, your lease, within your lease. Now, this is out of my territory, but if there is a big anchor store or a big chain that come in and want and need to have 40,000 square feet of space, and your space is happen to be within that requirement, they'll move you. You may have been in the ideal location, but within the lease document, if the landlord is sophisticated enough, they will set it up in a way that you can be relocated when it's necessary, and you're no longer in a prime space. You still pay the same rent. You don't have the control. Okay, like Jim said, you can be in the building and the landlords, you know, go bankrupt. Sold out. Whatever the case is, you will be affected. So, I think if you're in a position to buy, do so, or lease for short term as a stepping stone, and you know, save your money and work your plan B or your exit plan to get into your forever, you know, office. And so, I think we're in. You know, the majority of established dentists will actually advise you to own versus lease. Jim?
Right. Han, do you have one last question you want to throw in before we can before we call it quits tonight?
I do. Let me see. Well, I have two, but let's go with this one first. Okay. I'm starting out. I'm looking for space. I have no idea how big of a space I need, and I like, you know, I'm going to stay in the area. What do I do? How do I calculate or figure out the size of the, you know, the office I need, and how do I plan for future growth? Jim?
That's a good one. Chat? Yeah, that's a real good one. Now, Bill Hunsinger, our Dr. Bill, our our co-founder, obviously is perfect for that question. Unfortunately, we don't have him tonight, but Han and I have been around more than enough to be able to at least give you the basics of what Bill would say. First of all, Bill would say, if it's you and only you, along with your hygienists, you need anywhere from, typically, he said, to be able to do things right, a minimum of 5, maybe 6 operatories. And that's the beginning basis. That's your starting point. And then from that point, obviously, all the other amenities that you would, you know, accessory spaces that are part of the operatories. Now, Han, we calculate what, 350 to 400 square foot per op as our,
yep,
as our kind of rule of thumb.
Yep.
So, you know, if you do the math on that, your I don't have math in my head that fast anymore. It's getting crazy. Okay. So 400 square feet times 6 operatories is 2,400 square feet. And if you're 350 square feet times 6 operatories, you're 2,100 square foot. So somewhere in the 2,100 to 2,000, what did I say, 600? 2,400 square feet. And that's your kind of ballpark range. Now, if you ask the question about how do I expand, well, there's a variety of ways of expanding within that space. You could do it by the split shift scenario where you bring in another associate, or, you know, as you're growing and you bring in another doc and you do, you know, split shift, different hours, work weekends, every other weekends, that kind of stuff. Go back and listen to one of our podcasts about that. And it allows you to expand your client base, but not having to physically expand your building. Then it becomes the question of, okay, now, if that's expansion's not enough, then what do you do? Well, then you have to plan to be able to find a way to either acquire adjacent space, be it if you lease it or own it, buy it big enough that, in a sense, buy enough property big enough if you're going to buy, that you can expand and let the building grow as your practice grows. Does that make sense, Han?
Yes. There is one major thing that I often ignore. Okay, if you're going to physically expand and grow in a space, then the design of your space need to take all that into consideration. All right? Meaning, how do I do that?
Plan for it now, not plan for expansion,
yep,
later.
See the end game, okay? Plan for the end game. Because once in a while, I see a building that was designed for future growth. And they make the same mistake that a lot of people make, is that I got this space, I'm going to grow into the adjacent space, we just knock out the wall. Yes, but the layout was not done with that in mind. So you just kind of basically annex the next space, increase and minimize or reduce the efficiency because it was never designed for real appropriate expansion. What I mean is that is you're going to have 2 waiting rooms because of the expansion, 2 sterilization because of your expansion. You know, are you going to have redundancy in everything because you need additional space? If you design it appropriately, you will be able to expand with minimal headache, aggravation, and the end result will be a lot more cohesive. So
yeah,
plan
or
your plan.
Worse yet, Han, you end up having to shut the practice down, because you have to tear the interior guts of it out to be able to create a final efficient laid out office that works as opposed to something that is so inefficient that it becomes a detriment to you, actually, your practice itself.
Yeah, it's a lot of times that you came to the point where you convince yourself that this is the best as it can get. Okay, you start to settle. You failed to plan, therefore you settle. And that would be an unfortunate thing. So when you are in the process, whether it's a startup or a second office, you know, look at your future plan. What's going to happen as you grow? How is this going to be able to be executed? You know, what does it look like? Don't just simply say, I'm going to have my designer that's doing it for free draw me a 3,000 square foot box next to the office. Okay, that's not good enough. All right, you want to see what that roadmap looked like if you actually grow into that space. How is it going to be done? That way, it allows you to place things where it need to be, so that when you do that expansion, it is efficiently done.
Excellent. Thanks, sir.
Okay.
Well, this has been really a fun evening in the sense that we've hopefully answered a lot of specific questions. Please continue to send them in. If Han and I need to do more and more of these, we'll continue to do more and more of these questions and answer kind of show topics because we like doing them. We're specifically answering questions that you have on your mind. And hopefully that is a very useful tool, and it gives everyone else around that has an opportunity to hear this via either live or as a podcast an understanding that maybe they didn't think about, where it says, well, I never thought about that aspect. And so it gives that information out. And, you know, that's the goal of our show. It really is to help educate and to give out information so that everyone understands what needs to be done and in our mind, the right way of doing it, because there's a lot of ways out there to do it. Obviously, Han and I like to say ours is the right way. Don't we, Han?
Yes, we're the right way. Jim, so for our listener to look at the previous episodes, what do they do?
Just
how they
go
do
to
it?
Our web. Yeah, go to our website. You can go to our website, and I believe there's a link there that goes right to the podcast. Or you can also catch it on Blog Talk Radio. They're all there as well. So both of those, along with the area for the submit a question, is all under the website under Listen Live. So with that, we'd like to say thank you again. Glad to have the opportunity to spend some time with you. Hopefully, we have a very special guest for us next week. We're going to get that confirmed tomorrow. So next Tuesday, we're hopefully going to have a live special guest to be able to pick his brain about the unique aspect of what he does in the dental industry. I'll kind of leave that as a teaser. So looking forward to that. So with that, Han, I'll give you the last word.
I had a blast. I appreciate you plugging in and spending the hours with us. Until next time, have a good evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.